The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. Today on the show, I interview James L. Cambias on The Miranda Conspiracy, the newest addition to the Billion Worlds series. After that, we bring you part one of the serialization of Mark Van Name's John and Lobo novel, One Jump Ahead. Hi there, I'm Griffin Barber, your host for today's edition of the Bain Free Radio Hour. Born and raised in New Orleans, Mr. Cambias went to University of Chicago, getting an education in the history of science, which has served him well in the modeling possible futures for humanity. Since 2000, Mr. Cambias has written a lot of excellent short fiction for a who's who of the very best SF venues, receiving nominations for his work from many of the best-known awards organizations. His first novel, A Darkling Sea, was an impressive debut. He followed that up in 2015 with Corsair, about a near-future space heist, which is also one of my, on my shelves among my favorites. James then wrote Arcad's World and, in a slight departure from his usual, The Initiate, a fantasy novel, both published by Bain Books. He then penned The Godel Operation, debuting a new universe, that of the Billion Worlds. He followed that up with Scarab Mission, which we talked about previously on the Bain Free Radio Hour. The book we are here to talk about today is The Miranda Conspiracy, dealing with family, romantic relationships, politics, lost treasure, and oddly enough, conspiracy. The Miranda Conspiracy is set in the same 10th millennium of the Billion Worlds universe that the amazing Godel Operation set forth for us. Hello and welcome, James.
Glad to be here.
So, getting right to it, the hardest question first. What is the coolest aspect of the Miranda Conspiracy for you?
For me, the coolest aspect was creating the conspiracy. I don't know how much I want to spoil, but suffice to say, there is an underlying political conspiracy, and I wanted it to be a fair mystery for the reader, where I would plant clues so that potentially the reader could figure out what was going on, at least along with, if not maybe even ahead of, the characters. I don't know how, obviously some people might figure it out right away and others will be surprised, because that always happens.
Well, that's the best way to be doing it, right? Because your readers then are feeling that they're smarter than the average Joe, so.
I modeled some of it on the historical conspiracy of Catiline in ancient, in the Republic of Rome. Catiline was a member of the senatorial class who basically was plotting a coup, and Cato, the censor, was his nemesis and brought him down, and that's why I started the book with an epigraph from Cato.
I saw that. Very cool. So clearly you didn't stumble on it. You kind of had to work your way towards it, or did the characters kind of dictate it, the situation that you placed them in?
The characters, well, some of the characters are stock, were introduced in the Godel Operation, so I couldn't change them. The three main characters, Daslak and Z and Adya, or who they are.
Right.
But the others I could sort of, cast to fit their roles, so to speak. So,
yeah, I love Daslak and his, attending dinner parties, not because he wants to eat, but because he doesn't want to miss any family combat. That's very entertaining. His worldview its worldview is really interesting to be presented with when it in terms of, like, he's talking about the mechs and what's going on in that other space that it's able to kind of process that we cannot, that baseline humans can't.
It is sometimes interesting if you think of Daslak as she rather than he. Obviously in the stories, Daslak is it and is proud of that, but people tend to default to he, but it puts a very interesting different spin on things if you think of Daslak as she. For one thing, the relationship with Z becomes very different.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. That's true. So the Miranda Conspiracy, like its predecessors in the series, has a lot of SF's biggest ideas at its core. Transhumanism, singularity, uplift, cybernetic psychosurgery, the colonization of space, the colonization of moons,
What new and cool treasures emerge in the world building this time for us?
Well, there is the treasure. There is a, this was one of the foundational elements of the story. In fact, I got it from a paper, an economics paper about interstellar trade in the real, how it might actually work. And one of the things it talked about was, you know, there's the very long transit times, you know, on the order of centuries, so that the right. value of a cargo can change over the course of its voyage. And of course, obviously, like the risk premium would steadily go down and so on.
Right.
So the idea of this object traveling, which, you know, has been changing in value and is now starting to appreciate very rapidly, you know, that was one of the elements. And I worked out that, you know, if something is traveling from the Oort cloud, you know, tens of thousands of AUs, astronomical units from the sun, it's going to have a transit time on the order of centuries. So that
right. Way. Unless it's going too fast.
Yeah. That also gave me a nice get out of jail free card, because well into the process, I suddenly realized, oh, wait a minute, why can't they just ask the people who sent it what's in it? But then I thankfully did the math and it's like, oh, because there's too long of a speed of light delay. It'll get there before they can get an answer.
Timelines are a good thing sometimes.
Yes, that was very useful.
Very cool. So the Miranda conspiracy has at its heart relationships, family, chosen family, romantic partners or would-be partners, and politics all have a part to play against the backdrop of the billion worlds. I see a lot of chosen family in your work. Am I projecting, or is this a part and parcel of your vision for humanity ongoing as far as making us still human, even when we have all these transhumanist things going on?
Well, I like to use the older term friendship, because I think that is, it is odd how in the present day, it seems as if the concept of friendship is kind of, you know, again, people refer to their group of friends as their found family. No, I mean, I have friends and they're my friends. They're different from my family. I have a family too. There's also, you know, kind of an odd thing which shows up in a lot of fan fiction where people have difficulty disentangling friendships from sexual or romantic relationships. And it's like, no, those are different too. And so, you know, Daslak and Z are friends. Z and Adya are lovers.
Right.
You know, it and Adya and her family are family, and these are different relationships, and they put stresses on each other, right? Because most people have had at least a hint of the tension between your family and your romantic partner, because
right.
as you grow up and become cleave to someone else, then, you know, that's going to put stresses on the ties to your family, whether
yeah, absolutely.
Even if they, you know, even if they like your partner better than they like you.
That sounds familiar. Well, it's interesting that you say that too, because I believe I can't remember the name of the study, but they're talking about how in recent times part of the pressure that's been put on marriages is that you have to be my best friend too, and that's not necessarily the case, right? Friends are a different category.
Yeah, and that was something I remember my wife and I talked about fairly. We were noticing that earlier in you know, around the time we got married, that the idea of a couple having separate social circles has disappeared. You know, it used right. to be that a married couple would often have, you know, he would have his circle of friends and she would have her circle of friends, and they might overlap, but they wouldn't entirely overlap.
Right.
But I think with especially now with, you know, two career couples, you know, there's sort of a pressure to, well, you know, we're going to hang out with our friends because
right.
we only have time to hang out with one set of friends.
So right. And it's, I think it's detrimental, right? You know, you don't have the same thing with friendships, right? Your friends should be your friends. You can call them chosen family in that they're people that you choose to associate with, and your closeness of your relationship means that you'll overlook some things that are
yeah.
possibly problematic or you don't agree with because they're your chosen friends, but it's not quite the same as you've been raised by these people generally.
Or, you know, the other is, of course, you know, you chose this person to spend your life with.
Right. That's
a different dynamic. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting.
Although it is funny. I was thinking about, I was visiting some friends. I paid a visit to New Orleans recently and, you know, saw one of my old high school friends. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, we're probably about the closest friend each other has, even though we see each other about once a year.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it, if it's really friendship, it doesn't need that much maintenance generally. Yeah. Right, because the same things that made you friends in the back in the before times are still existing, right? They're hopefully they're still existing, and but that's also how you can drift apart a little bit too. But yeah, it is kind of fascinating. I have several friends like that too, from old friends from that. It's just like, yeah, we never really are not in each other's lives that much, but still the friendship is there, and we can call on each other at any point. So.
There's a marvelous bit in the movie Gross Point Blank where the main
one character, of my favorites,
who is a hitman, he's back at his high school reunion and he's you know reconnecting with one of his old high school buddies while they are disposing of a body, and at no point does his buddy ask who the guy that they're disposing of is or why they're doing it. It's just like, oh yeah, sure.
This is what we're doing. Yeah, this is what we're doing there. Yeah, that was a great scene. Yeah. So which character in the Miranda conspiracy surprised you?
Which one surprised me? I'm not often one of these writers who is surprised by his own characters, but I think in the case of Miranda, Adya's father did change more than I had expected while I was writing him. To be candid, he started off as a more or less one-dimensional character, but in the course of writing him, I wound up giving him more depth, and I think that made him a better character.
I enjoy the fact that he cooks his own fish that he catches. I thought that was cool. And he's kind of a
boy out of New Orleans, but
speaking of which, right? And you know, he's that right there gives you a whole dimension to play with, right? That you can interact with him or not interact with him, as the case may be, as far as watching him interact with his kids and be a bit of a snob about farm raised and that kind of thing. I enjoyed that quite a bit. So yeah, I could see where some of that fun comes from in the adding those dimensions to him.
Yeah, that's also a case of write what you know. It's like, okay, I'll make him a food snob. I can do that.
And so he came to be because Adya had to have a dad or at least a donor.
Yeah, you know, again, the social structure of Miranda is modeled a little bit on Republican Rome, so he is very much a patrician and even has some of the old Roman attitudes about, you know, he would rather die than be disgraced, right?
So in a similar vein to asking this question about the dying rather than be disgraced, which character from Miranda Conspiracy would you want to avoid like the plague and why?
Well, there's the answer, which if you have read the book, you know, but I'm not going to give that answer. So instead, I'm going to say probably I would avoid the Octopus crime lord Dai Chichi, because he is supposed to be really scary, because he's not only, you know, a Sydney Green Street style crime boss, but he's also a giant octopus.
See, for me, it's the sister. She's just, you know,
is annoying.
Well, and also just the right kind of annoying for me. Like, I don't mind dealing with somebody who's scary. But somebody who's just that, like, just that, gets me in my goat, as it were.
Some of the dynamics of that I've based on people I know about the, you know, the sibling rivalries. My sister and I are sufficiently far apart in age that there wasn't a whole lot of sort of direct rivalry. It was more the classic older sister, little brother dynamic, and we're actually quite friendly now.
The I did talk about this last time we talked about your work was the absence of social media in some of the stuff, but it seems like it's made an appearance on Miranda.
It did. I confess I was a little leery about that. I didn't want to seem to be, you know, projecting 21st century society 8,000 years into the future, but I do feel as if that something like that will continue to be, you know, I mean, okay, Kavita is what we would call an influencer, but, yeah, you know, 100 years ago, she would have been in the society pages. And
right. Probably, yeah, you know, absolutely.
That sort of thing has existed. And once we got beyond, well, you know, probably even in like rural Bronze Age villages, there were the people that everybody gossiped about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they ended up being in not necessarily Bronze Age, but certainly in the medieval age, they ended up being burned as witches or whatever, because they were just a little bit off and nobody really knew who they were. And
well, so, but you know, there were also the people who were organizing the witch hunts, right? You know,
yep. This will be a nice, a fun social activity.
Kavita says she's a witch. I guess she must be a witch.
Yeah. So which character would you want as an ally?
Well, depending on the situation, either Pelagia or Daslak. If I'm getting into a physical confrontation, I want Pelagia on my side because A, I don't want her to be on the other side, and yeah, B, she will definitely put forth her utmost. In anything else, I think Daslak is, you know, just 5 kilograms of awesome.
And the and the depth of experience that Daslak has too is quite impressive. So are any of them based on real people aside from perhaps you know, loosely based on senatorial rank members of Rome?
Well, there's a lot of me in Daslak, I think, at least in its attitudes. Many of my female characters are influenced by my wife and daughter. You know, it is probably no coincidence that I'm married to a scientist, and a great many of my female protagonists are slightly nerdy, you know. Although
cool.
Diane does not change color. So,
this is not a direct sequel to the last book to come out, The Scarab Mission, but a sequel to the original book of the Billion Worlds, The Godel Operation, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and can we hear the reasoning for this? What kind of went behind all that?
The reasoning for this is Bain Books, because when I had the original concept for the Billion Worlds series, I had this brilliant, what I refer to now as my brilliant stupid idea, which was I was going to be really avant-garde, and instead of telling a linear series, I was going to tell a slice, a bunch of stories all taking place at the same time. And there might be like cross references between them and the stuff. And I was informed that that was not really a very good idea, that that was going to, that readers like to have continuity of characters. And, you know, I just mentioned how much I like writing Daslak. I kind of like continuity of characters too, I've decided.
Yeah.
But the trouble is that advice came down when I was about a third of the way done with writing the Scarab Mission. So I had the option of, okay, I either have to come up with a different book to write, or I have to figure a way to fit Scarab Mission into a linear continuity with Godel Operation. And it couldn't go afterwards, so it had to go before. So Scarab Mission takes place 30 years before Godel Operation, involves mostly different people, but does have Daslak in it, because
yep,
that was my solution. Okay, I can put Daslak into this story, and Daslak started stealing every scene it was in.
Right.
It does. And I, you know, there's another character from Scarab Mission who shows up in Miranda Conspiracy. I won't say who. And in fact, those two are the focus of the book I'm currently writing, provisional title, The Ishtar Deception,
neat,
which follows so shortly thereafter the events of Miranda Conspiracy.
Very cool.
I may do some other side stories and prequels or whatever, but you know, it is in a linear.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that, as far as the in the timeline, is that when you have a character who is basically, to our all intents and purposes, almost immortal, and has memory issues, which I love. I mean, I absolutely love that about Daszak, in that they've lived so long, they're having to archive their own memories in order to retain their identity. But you can place things anywhere you want to in their timeline, kind of deal. I think that's an exceptionally cool look at not only this, not necessarily the singularity, but the mind transfer to a mechanical medium, and also to that longevity issue. How do you retain all of your experiences that inform you?
Right. So I'm, 58 years old, and there's stuff that I ought to remember that I don't, that, my wife will remind me of or whatever. Yeah. It's like, don't you remember we did that thing? I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it was exactly the way you're remembering it, but yeah, I remember something along those lines, I think. So, we talked last time about the probable, excuse me, the provable provenance of handmade items having an outsized value in the billion worlds. And in the intervening years, we've seen a lot of advancement in AI. I was wondering what your current thoughts on AI-generated content are, and what it means to the arts in general.
Well, at the moment, I think the threat is somewhat overrated because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I can tell AI art now when I see it. It's developed its own look. And, okay, that book cover in the upper right-hand corner was created by a human. You can tell.
And will always be.
At it.
That's one of the things Bain has said. We're always going to have human-created artwork for our covers,
Well,
et
good.
cetera.
But the and certainly AI written text, I can I you know I'm gonna flatter myself and say I can spot it about 9 times out of 10. Sometimes it's hard to tell it from just somebody who's not writing very well, but
True. It also depends on the length too, right? If it's just doing a small, short thing, probably not as
an
awful.
author bio paragraph, AI could probably write as well as I can.
Well, that's what my brother works in marketing, right? And that's one of the things he said, is that it has made his life so simple.
Oh, yeah.
Writing marketing copy,
Yeah.
dead
Catalog.
easy.
But I also think that we're still in the absolutely baby steps infancy of this field, and it is not too hard to believe that in 50 years, 100 years, I would err on the short side. The difference in quality will not be obvious. Now, I do think that what we are calling artificial intelligence isn't,
Yeah, me too. I agree.
and at some point I think, but at some point I think we will develop what is more like artificial intelligence. I mean, right now, an AI server farm uses, in some cases, like the output of an entire power plant, right? And yet we know that you can power an intelligent something of human intelligence off of, I think, 20 watts. So we're obviously brute forcing it right now. And at some point, the more elegant methods that can more closely emulate human intelligence will develop, I think.
And then the other aspect of it, interesting you talk about the power requirements, because my cousin is also she's a nuclear engineer and a nuclear physicist. She's both master's and PhD, much smarter than me. Totally different family tree. Anyway, she talks about her age cohort, which is people in their 30s, being hired by Google and other larger industry folks to construct small fission power plants. When I say small, I mean like semi-trailer truck sized, so they can power the server farms.
I'm really waiting for that. I mean, I would, like I don't know if I mentioned while we were setting up that, I'm involved in some of the finance matters for the town I live in. And, something that could power a town of 5,000 people and be run as basically a little local utility would not be a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a step back to the days of when that actually was going on in the early 20th, and it
Yeah.
wasn't that hard to do, right? Yeah, so it'll be interesting if that goes cheap enough to become.
It's also kind of amazing to me, and in a good way, it restores my faith in human nature or whatever, that the strident opposition to nuclear power has kind of died away. I don't know what happened, but I can remember just a decade or so ago, the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant, about 30 miles away from where I live here, was shut down, and there were some, local lifelong activists, shall we say, crowing over it. And I, couldn't avoid mentioning the fact that, yeah, fracking really did end that power plant, didn't it? But they don't seem to be. They've moved on to other things or something. I don't know.
Well, it's proven because we've been doing it for how many years now? And aside from other nation states having really, really, really bad generalized accidents or incidents, I should say, and the Japanese suffering an unprecedented earthquake that could damage that, and our own Long Island, there haven't been a lot of issues.
Now that you mention it, Fukushima might actually have been like the best. I mean, because that's like Chernobyl aside, that's kind of like the worst case scenario for a not built by drunk communists nuclear power plant. And
And operated by.
it was bad, but Japan's still there. Godzilla did not actually emerge from the ocean. After I watched the HBO series Chernobyl, and
Well,
I always refer to that as the greatest Lovecraftian horror film ever made, because the twin horrors of the reactor and the Soviet state,
response to it, yeah, just unbelievably bad. Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, so we got a little bit of far field from the AI. I totally agree with you on the fact that what we're talking about is AI is certainly not advanced artificial general intelligence. Right now they're pretty much inexpert systems
That's what they're
doing
saying.
something that eventually will become a very expert system. I'm sure of it. The power requirements are going to be, I think, the big stumbling block is, are we going to approve these nuclear power plants that could just kind of pick up and drive away? Some of these things are that small. I'm interested to see where that's going to turn up in the future, especially given that if the current easing of anti-nuclear power, if that ramps back up again to its former state, we may see it come back pretty fast. But yeah, I think that response about the fracking is a good one. On a personal note, and I know I've asked you this before, but did I hear you're already hard at work on a fourth or fifth book in the series, or maybe both?
I am. It's called the Ishtar Deception, and it is a James Bond novel in the dawn of the 11th millennium, or the end of the 10th millennium.
Neat, very neat.
And
Okay, so any hints on when that might be dropping?
well, I still have to finish writing it, and then it had some Bane team have to put it on the schedule, so I'm not going to predict when that'll be.
Okay. What games are you currently playing? Are you doing anything recently?
I have not written any new games. Well, let me correct that. I have written a couple of game products. I've started putting up a few little sort of system agnostic products on Drive-Thru RPG, mostly as sort of generic science fiction game supplements. So the first one was called Planetary Events, and it's basically, if you're running an outer space campaign, here's stuff to have happen on the various planets in your setting, so that the players can get a sense that stuff happens even when they're not causing it
Very cool.
themselves.
So
And
useful for traveler or
yeah, I mean, Traveler is sort of the default,
right.
obviously. You can use it for any space type game.
Cool.
And then the more recent one, which I'm just putting up this past week, is I guess a little bit of sort of me being cranky in game supplement form, because I've noticed that a lot of science fiction role-playing games do not involve a lot of science fiction once you get past the equipment list. So, okay, I'll dunk on Traveler here for a moment. If you go through the old 76 Patrons, Adventure Hook book,
Right.
I believe, I don't remember which of the designers even said that a lot of them were taken from old Rockford Files episodes. And, so, which, okay, it's the greatest show in television history. It never jumped the shark. But, at the same time, it was 1970s California. And, I'm always very fond of the idea that if you can, that your science fiction stories should require the science fiction elements.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I wrote up a book, a product called Thrilling Science, Science Fiction Elements for Role-Playing Games, in which basically, here's some science fiction stuff to put in your adventure.
Very cool. Very, actually, yeah, I'd buy that. Because it is one of those things, because there's so many, usually it comes down to the super weapon, if it
Super
touches
weapon, right?
science at all.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be. It could be any number of things. How about we destabilize grain prices across the universe because we've come up with the grow as you go method or whatever. Yeah, that's interesting. I like that. Like I said, I'd buy it. So we're on to our penultimate question here. What, aside from its raw entertainment value, do you hope readers will carry with them long after they've read the Miranda Conspiracy?
Well, obviously the raw entertainment value is primary. Also, I guess the sense that political events are often driven by personal motives. And that's just as true in 21st century United States as it is in 10th millennium Miranda, as it is in the, first century Roman Republic, that, there's the political scientist James Buchanan, calls it public choice theory, where you analyze what the incentives are on a personal level for the officials, not just what their job description is. And
Right.
this is how you get corruption. This is how you get irrational decision making. This is how you get Plantagenet princes who are already the legitimate heir to the throne, trying to violently seize the throne because they just got bored waiting for the.
Yeah, we got tired of it. Yeah, tired
Yeah.
of the Interesting. All right. So last question, what conventions can your fans hope to catch up with you at? And what other work do you have in the pipeline? You already talked about the game supplement material that you've put out and I'm going to buy.
So there's the game supplement. I have no short stories. Well, I have one short story which I have not yet been able to sell. It's out. I'm waiting to hear back from the latest market I sent it to. It's getting harder to sell short fiction because publications keep dropping out. It's a little saddening. There's so that I don't have that much else in the pipe at the moment, although I am self-publishing or self-reprinting some of my earlier works. So I've got Darkling Sea back up on Amazon in ebook form under my own imprint, and in the near term I'm going to be bringing Corsair also to Amazon that way.
I still love Coursera. That was a great book.
And I'm trying also to produce an audiobook version of Darkling Sea, because when it was published by by Tor, audiobooks were still a box of CDs. And now I need to get it in, and I don't own that. So now I have to get a hold of, someone to record it, and produce it. Yes, as to conventions, I will be at LibertyCon in Chattanooga this summer, BAME's home-based convention. I am usually in attendance at AlbaCon in Albany in September. And I will probably be at PhilCon in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, in November. There may be others, but those are the ones I'm relatively sure of. I mean, I've
Neat.
got hotel rooms already for LibertyCon, so I'm definitely going to that.
There we go. That was one of the things with me with my recent change of home. I'm like, am I gonna rent a hotel room or am I? Yeah, I'm gonna rent a hotel room. I'm not gonna go home every night. So thank you very much again, James. This has been Griffin Barber in conversation with James L. Cambius, author of The Miranda Conspiracy, available wherever you buy your Bain books. Thank you for being with us today, James.
Thank you for having me.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Macken, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
Audible Frontiers presents One Jump Ahead, written by Mark L. Van Name, narrated by Tom Stekschulte.
Chapter 1. Maybe it was because the girl reminded me of Jenny, my lost sister and only family, whom I haven't seen in over 100 years. Maybe it was because Lobo was the first interesting thing I'd met in a while. Maybe it was because it was time to move on. Because I'd been healing and lazing on Macken long enough. Maybe it was because I had a chance to do some good and decided to take that chance. Not likely. But maybe the time on Macken had healed me more than I thought, healed me enough that I was reconnecting with the human part of me. Also not likely, but I choose to hope. Whatever the reason, I was lying on my back in the bottom of a 4-meter-deep pit, waiting for my would-be captors to fetch me. As jungle traps go, it was a nice one, not fancy, but serviceable. They'd made it deep enough to keep me in when I fell, but shallow enough that I'd only be injured, not killed, from the fall. They'd blasted the walls smooth, so climbing out wouldn't be easy. The bottom was rough dirt, but without stakes, another welcome sign they hadn't wanted to kill me. The covering was reasonably persuasive, a dense gray-green layer of rainforest moss resting on twigs. In the dark, it passed as just another stretch of ground in the jungle, as long as you were using only the normally visible light spectrum. In IR, its bottom was enough cooler than the rest of the true jungle floor, and its sides were enough warmer from the smoothing blasts that the pit stood out as an odd red and blue box beneath me. Not that I needed the IR. Lobo was chummy with a corporate surveillance sat that was supplying him data, and he had a bird-shaped battlefield recon drone circling the area. So he'd warned me about the trap well before I reached it. The drone wouldn't have lasted 2 minutes in a battle where the best result you could expect was a burst of surveillance data before enemy defenses shot it down. But these folks were so clearly amateurs that Lobo and I agreed the drone wouldn't be at risk. You don't spend much time alone in jungles before you either die or learn to always carry at least a knife, food, water, and an ultra-strong lightweight rope. I'd kicked in the pit's cover, looped the rope around the closest tree, lowered myself into the hole, and pulled in the rope. After a light dinner of dried meat and fruit, I decided to relax and enjoy the view a small gap in the jungle canopy afforded me. Lying on my back, looking up past the pit's walls to the sky above trees so ancient that luminescent white flowers grew directly from their trunks, I saw so many stars I could almost believe anything was possible somewhere. If you spend all your time on industrialized planets, you have no clue as to the beauty and brilliance of a night sky without light pollution. You can see pictures and videos, but they're not the same. They lack the fire, the sense of density of light that you get from the sky on a planet still early in the colonization process. The view of Mackin's stars from its surface would slowly blur as its population grew. The new jump aperture ensured growth even more surely than the planet's amazing beaches. But for now, I could enjoy a view most will never know they've missed. Lobo's voice, coming from the receiver in my ear, interrupted my reverie. John, you are early. Why? I thought their camp was nearby. It is. But as you were climbing into the pit, they were heading to Glenn's garden. I monitored the alarm their sensors triggered, and so did they. But apparently, they decided to let you rot for a bit. I thought about climbing out, but I couldn't finish the job if I left the area. So why trade one bit of jungle for another? On the other hand, simply waiting, doing nothing while these amateurs enjoyed some R&R in town was going to make me cranky. I've learned on past missions that you should always rest when you can, so I decided to put this time to good use. I'm going to take a nap, I said. Wake me when they're within a click or so. Will do. Want some music? I listened to the low but persistent buzz of the jungle, the wind, the insects, the flow of life around me. And I thought back to simpler childhood days, watching the sunset on the side of the mountain on my home island on Pinkelponker. Pinkelponker. It was a silly name. The kind of name the captain of the generation ship that crashed there should have expected when he let his young son name the planet. When I was a kid, the name made me smile. Now, though, my memories of the place were pleasant but hollow, leached of resonance by time, by what the planet's government had done to Jenny and me, and by the possibility that the entire world no longer existed. Despite the memories, I found a welcome peace in the sounds and in the lush scent that filled the forest. No, there's music enough here. Thanks, though, for the offer. Lobo couldn't exactly sigh, but I had to admire his emotive programming once again, because I was sure I heard exasperation in his voice as he said, "Whatever you want, I will be back to you when they are close." I enjoyed the stars a moment more, then closed my eyes and thought about the path that had led me here. The house I had rented on Mackin was well away from Glen's Garden, the closest city and the capital of the planet's human settlement. In the morning fog, the building appeared to rise out of the sand, a simple A-frame built from native woods, reinforced with metal beams and coated pilings. Its entire front was an active glass window facing the ocean. The tides pounded slowly and gently against the beach 100 meters away, waging a long-term, low-key war with the shoreline that they'd eventually win. I'd come for solitude, so I'd paid in advance for half a year. Stupid. I should have paid by the week like most people. Should have known that anyone spending that much money at one time in a colony like this one had no chance of staying alone for long. I figured that out after the fact, however. So between long swims in the ocean, short but frequent bouts of disturbed sleep, and even longer periods staring out the house's front, the glass tuned to the clearest possible setting, I made friends with some appliances and started gathering the local intelligence I knew my mistake would inevitably make me need. I suppose I could have left, taken my vacation on another planet, but I liked this house. I'd spent a lot of money on it, and most of all, I didn't feel like having to find another place to rest. Washing machines are the biggest gossips in the appliance world. so I had cozied up to mine early. They talk nonstop among themselves, but it's all at frequencies people, humans, can't hear. At some point in the course of their educations, most people still learn that the price we've paid for putting intelligence everywhere is a huge population of frequently disgruntled, but fortunately, behaviorally limited machines. But just about everyone chalks it up to the cost of progress. I've seen some organizations try to monitor and record the machine chatter, but in short order, the recorders warn the other machines, and then they all go quiet until the people give up and move on.
This has been the Bain Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week for more One Jump Ahead and our next interview when Haley Greger interviews Casey Azell on her collection of noir anthologies, Noir Fatale, No Game for Knights, and Down These Mean Streets. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.